You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows that the number of drivers who use their phones while driving is way higher than previous estimates. We'll look at how we're doing in Wisconsin and what we can do to be safer behind the wheel. First, Wisconsin was hammered with an unusually heavy spring storm that brought rain, sleet, freezing rain, ice, and lots of snow to much of the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is it like where you are? How did it affect your weekend, the start of the work and school week? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll talk with meteorologist Jeff Last about what factors combine to create this weather event. First, WPR reporter Patty Murray joins us from Green Bay, which was particularly hard hit with snowfalls over 2 feet. Patty, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So we've been hearing some reports of significant damage up there from all the snow and ice. What are you hearing?
Well, there have been ice shoves off of Lake Michigan. They've had winds of like 30 to 40 miles an hour, and that's been causing, you know, the ice to jam up onto the shorelines and possibly damaging some properties there and causing floodings. There's also been some roof collapses. You know, when you have a large, you know, kind of flat-roofed building, you get all of this heavy, wet snow that we've had. And, yeah, the roof literally crashes in. A hotel, a dairy barn. There was an apartment building that the parking garage crashed in on. So, yeah, there's been some, you know, property damage out of this storm.
And what are you hearing from transportation and city officials coming out of the weekend now? Are they still telling people keep off the roads at this point?
Well, the DOT did issue a tow ban. So, like, if your car went into the ditch on the highway, they weren't going to tow it out for you. You know, you're pretty much on your own in that respect. And parking bans on city streets, definitely. And there were also Brown County and Outagamie counties told, quote-unquote, non-essential employees not to report to work today, basically just saying it's a snow day.
Now, this April, we've seen a lot of snow and cold weather. It's been a little, I think, demoralizing for people looking forward to spring. But this is a snowfall. This isn't just because it's April. This is a big deal in January or February if you get this much snow.
This is like the biggest snow since 1888. That's 1888. So, yeah, this is, you know, a big dump. It's like 2 feet of snow in Green Bay.
And how are people in the area coping? Are they still ready to dig out the shovels and snow blowers this late in the season?
Actually, I went over and begged my neighbor to, I saw he had a snowblower that was functioning, and begged him to just try to dig my car out of the driveway. So, yeah, I mean, this is Wisconsin. You know, I mean, it's April. It shouldn't be snowing this much in April, I don't think. I'm not a meteorologist.
We will talk to a meteorologist in a couple minutes, but I understand, Patty, you at least had a little fun in the snow.
Well, a little bit. You know, I tried to make a little snow creature. You know, I didn't do so well, but, you know, it is what it is.
There's a lot of snow. It wasn't great packing snow?
No, it is good packing snow. It's a heavy snow. It's a heavy, wet snow.
All right, Patty, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date. Stay safe.
You're welcome.
Patty Murray is a WPR reporter based in Green Bay. You can share your snow stories from the weekend now at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, especially if you're in those parts of central and northeastern Wisconsin that got double-digit 20-inch-plus snowfalls. 800-642-1234 is that number. Now we turn to Jeff Last for a look at some of the causes behind this weather event. He's warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, last time we talked to you, Jeff, it was for kind of an unusual, unseasonable snowfall early in April. Well, this puts that to shame. This is a lot bigger deal.
It sure was, and back when we spoke earlier in the month, I didn't think we would get something as big as this in mid-April. But sure enough, a record snowfall, a big record breaker across much of northeast Wisconsin.
Yeah, can you talk about some of the areas that were hardest hit by this in communities?
Well, anywhere from Door County, Sturgeon Bay area, west toward Green Bay, of course, the Shawano area, Waupaca County, even into to Portage County, that stripe, about 60 or 80 miles wide, was really hard hit with, as you mentioned, 20 inches or more of a wet, heavy snow.
And as we said with Patty there, this is a noteworthy snow, I don't care what month it is, right?
Absolutely. This snowstorm here in mid-April broke records for any time of the year at many locations, including Appleton. Here in Green Bay, it was the second largest snowstorm on record, again, for any time of the year. So just an incredible historic storm.
So what were the conditions that fed into this thing?
Well, it's what we look for when we're forecasting big storms. And this time of year, it's not unusual to have these strong low-pressure systems, which really was the culprit here. But what was unusual this time around was a very cold, high-pressure system up in Canada, which funneled a continuous feed of cold air from Canada into the upper Midwest. And that was just enough to keep what could have been a lot of rain. It kept it snow for an extended period of time. And, of course, all the wind whipping it up produced this historic blizzard.
I want to bring on a caller now. Martha is with us in Stevens Point. Martha, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your snow story? You got a good...
Oh, my goodness gracious. We have 2 feet of snow here. My husband is looking at me thinking, well, we should do the driveway. But we're not going to. We're going to jump in the truck and go
oh, no.
snowboarding up in Wausau. So we drove 30 miles to get the best snow of the season.
Well, I hope you've got a good truck.
And I'm 61, and I'm out there on a snowboard. So... have fun in Wisconsin, right?
All right, Martha, thanks a lot. Stay safe driving and up on the board, too. Let's go to Patrick in Brookfield now. Patrick, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What's your snow story, Patrick?
Well, I just wanted to say I was glad the snow came last weekend instead of weekend before last, because I attended a World War I reenactment at Midway Village Museum, Rockford, Illinois. It was a very good show. They had a French Schneider tank, a Model T ambulance, a Model T with a machine gun mounted on it. They put on a series of mock battles.
All right, Patrick, so the snow didn't spoil your event. Thanks for that. We heard from Jason, who emails. He's been working to plow this snowstorm in Green Bay. Hasn't been able to see his family since Friday night. Wow. Thank you for sharing those snow stories. Let's talk about the kind of snow that Jason was plowing there, Jeff. As Patty said earlier, this is a wet, heavy snow, right?
Yeah, it is. And that certainly is not unusual for these April storms. A lot of moisture in the air. The air isn't frigid cold, but just cold enough to produce those large snowflakes, which kind of stick together and are very difficult to move off of driveways and the roads.
So I think one thing people are wondering about, Jeff, is this just a freak thing this year, or is there some kind of climate changing thing, a different pattern going on where maybe we're going to see more wild events in April?
Well, it's hard to say. We can't pin one event, one storm, on a trend, but certainly if you look at the last 10 or 20 years, a lot of our storms have been stronger, and while we have seen the global climate change, no question about that, it doesn't mean that you can't have cold, you can't have snow. In fact, you can have more cold and more snow as the global climate changes. So, again, I can't say that we're going to have more storms like this in the future just based on what happened here over the weekend, but certainly it's something we're keeping a close eye on.
And, Jeff, just the short-term forecast, are we going to see it warm up enough to melt all this stuff anytime soon?
Yes. The good news is that as we look into the next week or so, a gradual warm-up, we do have a chance of some snow again over parts of central Wisconsin on Wednesday, but only 1 to 3 inches perhaps. But in general, temperatures into the 40s and 50s toward the second half of the week into the weekend, a slow melt with temperatures at night falling below freezing. So that's good news because there's a lot of water content in this snow.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jeff Last, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service based in Green Bay. He joined us to talk about the unusual winter storm that blanketed the state over the weekend. We also heard from reporter Patty Murray in Green Bay. Coming up, when it comes to using our phones while driving, Wisconsin is in the middle of the pack, but we're getting worse along with pretty much the whole rest of the country. We'll talk about the risks of distracted driving and how to prevent it coming up on Central Time. New research shows that America's distracted driving problem may be way, way worse than we used to think. 2015 numbers from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration showed that during daylight hours, 660,000 drivers used their phones while behind the wheel. It also said distracted driving took the lives of nearly 3,500 people. We may be doing even worse than we thought, though, according to a new study by ZenDrive. That's a San Francisco-based company that tracks phone use for auto insurers and ride-hailing services. They say, nah, more like 69 million drivers using their phones behind the wheel each day. Have you seen this? 800-642-1234. Do you see more people driving distractedly using their devices? Will you own up to doing it yourself? Maybe don't call right now if you are driving. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jonathan Mattis joins us now. He's founder and chief executive officer of ZenDrive, the group behind that study. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, talk about how you got behind the wheel with so many drivers. Talk about the research that led you to these numbers.
Sure. So ZenDrive is in the business of analyzing driver behavior and helping fleets, insurers, cities, regulators, and others prevent that kind of risky, distracted phone use on the road. And over the past few years, we've analyzed more than 100 billion miles of driving data. And we've looked at specifically data from December 2017 to February 2018 to analyze what is the current trend of distracted and risky driver on the road. And in looking at that data and comparing it to a similar study with, again, millions and millions of drivers from a year before, we found some unfortunate trends where overall distracted driving is on the rise. And particularly for your listeners in Wisconsin, there are some additional concerning factors.
Let's talk about those. What are you seeing in Wisconsin?
So Wisconsin, previously on the national ranking of states, was on the 18th position as least distracted state. Unfortunately, it dropped by 7 places, and so now it's on the 25th, which is kind of smack in the middle. And you would hope that over time things will improve, but unfortunately, Wisconsin is also one of the states without regulation preventing people from talking on the phone while driving. I believe you have regulation for texting while driving, but not for speaking on the phone while driving. And the results might be perceived in this study.
And it looks like in your study, pretty much every state, all but one state, I guess, in the whole country got worse between the 2 years of this study.
That's true. So Wisconsin is not an exception to the rule here. The trend nationally and globally, I would say, is that distracted phone use is on the rise, and the result is probably and unfortunately more fatalities on the road. The statistics in the U.S. and particularly in Wisconsin are quite scary. So the Department of Transportation for Wisconsin reported that 25,000 car crashes happen every year in the state due to distracted driving. So, you know, if you do the math, that's about one crash every 20 minutes every day, all day. That's a lot.
And some people might hear you say, oh, you know, talking on the phone is a problem. They think, okay, I don't text, I don't look at the map on my phone, but talking, is that really a problem? How does that fit into the distracted driving picture?
It is. So it's a form of distracted driving. And granted, you can still pay attention to what's happening on the road, but you know how it is. We humans have a limited set of attention resources that we can at any point in time use for driving and for doing other things. And the more you stack up the amount of tasks that we're responsible for, whether it's texting or calling or putting makeup on, whatever it is, the less focused we are on what's happening on the road. And unfortunately, for every second where our eyes are not on the road, or we're daydreaming or paying more attention to the conversation than we are to what's happening around us on the highway, you know, at 60 miles an hour, we're talking about football fields over football fields of blind driving. And that's very, very risky.
Jonathan Mattis is with us, founder and CEO of Zendrive. They study distracted driving, phone use while driving. And according to their numbers, we are doing this. We in Wisconsin, we in the United States are driving while using our phones a lot. We're getting worse at it over time, and it is a hazard. Kendra called in at 800-642-1234, calling from Milwaukee. She says in the last 2 weeks, she saw a woman texting while turning left in an intersection. Kendra says if that's not a recipe for an accident, she doesn't know what is. So you were talking about kind of straightaway driving there, Jonathan, with that football field, making a left turn even worse, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. The more complex the driving and the more complex the environment, the more risky it is. So we have some tips that we believe can help drivers. And that's also related to some of the data that we found in this massive study. Again, no one has ever looked at this huge amount of driving behavior before. And one of the patterns that came out that was perhaps surprising was that most of the distracted driving happens in the first 5% or so of the trip. So if you're, you know, driving for an hour or so, we're talking about the first few minutes. And so the opportunity here for reversing some of this risky trend is to encourage people as they get into the car and either finish that email or put on Google Maps or play the music, to complete everything and anything that they want to do with their phone before they turn the car on, before they get on the highway coming out of the parking spot. And if you can make sure that your phone is in the mount and your eyes are on the road for that duration of that commute, everyone, including your family, will feel much better.
So if we have that frustrating moment or we get going and Spotify or whatever streaming service we're trying to play music on just isn't firing up, maybe pull over instead of trying to diagnose it as we pull onto the highway?
Exactly.
And there are some states you mentioned that have more strict laws on distracted driving. Do those laws seem to make a difference in what we're actually doing on the road?
You know, that's a very good question. It seems like the laws by themselves aren't enough. So, you know, laws or regulatory or legislative action is an important part of preventing this problem, but it's not sufficient by itself. In addition to that, you want to make sure that there is plenty of education. So the kind of thing that we're having now, people should be aware of that problem, and not just in radio. It should be in classrooms. It should be a part of the discussion around new drivers getting on the road. So that's the other aspect. And thirdly, smart enforcement. So I don't know how are you when you're on the road, but personally, when I'm on the road and I see the flashlights of a police officer that's parked nearby on the highway, I'm less likely to pick up the phone and text. And so if you could place police in the right locations, or if you could place the right cameras in the right locations, perhaps individuals will be less likely to use their phone in distracting fashion. And so the information and the data that Zendrive has collected, of course, in an anonymized aggregate way, can help use enforcement in a smarter fashion and prevent some of these fatalities.
Is this maybe a culture thing too, Jonathan, where, you know, surveys show that the vast majority of Americans think we're above average drivers, and we might think, yeah, I don't want all those other people doing their distracted driving, but I can handle it. I'm such a good driver. I can do this little thing, no problem.
You're absolutely right. I think the stat is something like 75 or 80% of drivers believe they're better than average, and that's mathematically impossible. And that's a tendency that humans have, you know, to overestimate their capabilities, not just in driving, in pretty much everything. But the numbers, the hard numbers, indicate that distracted phone use is on the rise, perhaps because of the larger number of millennials and teenagers on the road. One way or the other, we need to try and reverse the trends, because we're talking about thousands and thousands of crashes just in Wisconsin, and many, many thousands of fatalities in the U.S. that could be prevented.
Now, I have seen when I've been in a cab or a shuttle or whatever kind of commercial car thing, the drivers, they live and breathe by looking at that phone to see where they're going, look for their next fare, that sort of thing. Can corporations, can commercial entities make a difference here?
Absolutely. And that's actually the core business for Zendrive. We are helping fleets and we're helping insurers in preventing and in reducing this type of behavior. So there are sophisticated technological ways of doing that. The technology that Zendrive is building and that is used by many, many customers is used exactly for that. So whether it's lightweight coaching or just a better understanding of which drivers are risky and why, that can help a lot in the commercial context. And we've seen tremendous success in reducing that type of behavior.
Now, I've seen stats that suggest that after getting better in terms of preventing highway fatalities over a bunch of years, preventing crashes, the numbers are getting worse. We're crashing more. People are dying more in crashes. I don't know how much of that is pinned on distracted driving. Do you think that is part of the equation, though?
I do. And there's an interesting correlation that you can actually dive into. If you look at the financial results for insurance companies that operate in the auto space, or if you look at the trend in the number of crashes, you will see an interesting correlation between the ubiquity and the popularity of smartphones and a trend of an increase in crashes and a decrease in profitability of insurance companies in the auto space. And the reason is that both the risk models that insurance companies used and the enforcement and legislation and education paradigms that were true 10 years ago are no longer true. And the world has changed faster than what the regulatory environment or the insurance companies were able to change their processes around. And so what we're trying to do with this study and with our business here at Zendrive is to help bring the awareness and bring the tools that are necessary to reverse this trend.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Jonathan Mattis is the founder and chief executive officer of Zendrive, based in San Francisco. As you heard, they track phone use for auto insurers and ride-hailing services, among others. We talked with them about a new study they did of the growing problem of smartphone use behind the wheel. It's tax day tomorrow, and Republicans in Washington are saying many Americans should be seeing more money in their paychecks. That's after the GOP tax cuts were signed into law last year. Here's President Trump celebrating the cuts last week.
We've passed the biggest tax cut and reform in American history. More than 5 million workers have already received a tax cut bonus, a pay raise, or a new job thanks to these really massive tax cuts.
Have you seen a difference from the tax cuts yet in your paycheck or at your business? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our next guest is here to talk about how those tax cuts are playing out around the country. Chai-Ching Huang is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Chai-Ching, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the timing first of all. Some of the impact of the tax cuts we probably won't feel until next year's tax time, but what are we seeing so far?
That's right. So most people see the impact of taxes either throughout the year as taxes are withheld from their paychecks as an estimate of how much they'll owe at the end of the year. And then at the end of the year, there's a calculation to see how right or wrong that withholding was, and people either have to pay more or might receive a refund depending on whether or not they had the right amounts withheld.
And this was passed in December, which means there wasn't much time to calculate how withholding should work, right? So is there a thought that those estimates of how much gets taken out of our paycheck for income tax, is there a thought that that might be a little hit or miss?
So like many of the things, I don't envy the IRS having to try to implement this massive tax change. I think they've done as well as they could possibly do with the complexity that this law creates. But you've brought up a really great point. I think there is a risk for many people that their withholding may have changed in a way that they didn't expect. So it's important to check to see whether or not the withholding is as you would want it. Many people prefer to receive a refund at the end of the year rather than risk having to pay money back to the IRS. So that's something that's important to check and see if it's targeting what you would like to see.
So with all that said, do we have a sense of, you know, are a lot of people out there looking at their paychecks and saying, yep, it adds up, it's a little higher than it was last year at this time because of these tax cuts?
Well, polls have been saying that about half of people, in fact, over half of people haven't noticed paycheck increases, despite the fact that the bill overall generally delivers tax cuts to households, with tax increases on a small number of households. Now, my guess is to the main reason for that is that for the vast bulk of working and middle-income households, the tax cuts are a modest amount, particularly relative to the amount that high-income and corporations are getting. So if you take that modest amount and then you spread it across the year, coming in your paychecks every 2 weeks or months, calculations are that about 56% of families would see a tax change of $20 or less every 2 weeks. So you can forgive people for not necessarily noticing that right off the bat.
And then it sounds like they might or might not notice it come tax time next year. If a little more was deducted, they're not necessarily going to see a bigger refund. It's kind of a slow, steady trickle if they are seeing more money in the paycheck.
That's exactly right. The withholding might not be exactly right, so people might receive a lower refund than they did last year, even though they might be paying less in taxes overall. There are some people for whom actually face a tax increase and may actually pay back more at the end of the year. About 7% of households across the country will actually face tax increases, so some of those people may find that out at the end of the year.
Chai Ching Huang is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We're looking at the impact of the tax changes passed in December by Republicans in Congress. Chai Ching, we've been talking so far about the direct tax impact. In that quote we heard from the president there, he was talking about the economic benefit of the tax cut. He's making the case that, hey, this is already resulting in more jobs or people getting bonuses on the jobs. I know it's still early, just a few months in. Are we seeing economic impacts from these tax cuts?
Look, I think most mainstream serious economists would say that it's far too early to tell what the long-run economic impact of this is going to be. And at the moment, they're sort of dueling anecdotes. The ones that the tax cut supporters are tending to push the fact that some firms have paid out bonuses. Now, that's not necessarily indicative of long-term wage increases. Bonuses are one-off. And in fact, because the corporate tax rate is cut under the bill, there's an incentive for corporations to bring forward compensation that they can deduct at the higher 35% rate. So some of that bonuses might be them moving forward wages that they would have paid in 2018 and later so that they can have the bigger deduction in 2017. So that's not something that I think is indicative of the long-run impact of the bill. The other thing to note is that many of these companies that have been delivering bonuses have also been spending far, far more on buying back shares. Now, that's a way of companies to deliver cash to their shareholders. It's like a dividend or some other way to pay out cash to shareholders. Now, when they're paying out cash to shareholders, that means that they're not investing it, which is one of the main ways that supporters of these big corporate tax cuts said they would flow through to workers through higher investment.
Right. That was a big hope of the tax cuts, the idea that corporations were reluctant to invest money because of the high corporate taxes in the United States. The tax cuts would free up their willingness to spend on investing in their businesses and thus creating more jobs. You're saying more of that money is going towards stock buybacks instead.
And one particular element of that story was that not only would there be more investment over the long run, but there would be a glut of investment because companies would be bringing back foreign profits under this law. And it's true that the law requires a one-off tax on profits that large multinationals have held offshore and allows them to free up that cash to do with what they like. Now, what we've been seeing, again, is a glut of many of those large multinationals announcing buybacks rather than new investment.
I've heard from some people on the Ideas Network Facebook page about this. Deb on Facebook says, yes, she does have more take-home pay now. So some people, Deb is noticing it, some people will notice it. Who would be the most likely, what economic sector would be most likely to be looking at their, I don't know, biweekly or monthly paycheck and saying, yeah, I do see a difference because of this tax plan?
Right. So again, overall, the majority of households would see a tax cut. But for working and moderate income families, for example, in Wisconsin, people in the first, second, and third fifths of the income distribution, so the bottom 60% of filers and those in the middle, their tax cuts average around about $400 to $500. So again, spreading that across the year, it might be $20 or so in every 2 weeks. The people who will notice it most, however, are those at the very top of the income distribution. High earners, and particularly investors, are going to see rather large increases in their after-tax profits and their take-home pay. So for the richest 1% in Wisconsin, their average tax cut is $50,000, in fact, more than that, a year.
We also heard from Karen on Facebook, who says she hasn't really seen a change for her, and now she also has no incentive to donate money. Can you talk about how these changes affect donations and how we claim them?
Sure. So the law actually made a number of different changes that affect charitable donations. And I think a lot of people are going to be watching to see over the course of this year how that does actually impact the nonprofit sector. So the first and most obvious way is that there's a limitation on the amount of charitable deductions that can be taken. And that's because there's limitations on itemized deductions generally, which means that many more filers, it makes more sense to take the standard deduction rather than keep a record of their deductions for charities, for home mortgage interest, and for state and local taxes, and instead just claim the standard amount that's available to everybody now, that's over $20,000 per couple now. So that's one of the reasons why charitable donations from a tax perspective become less attractive. Another reason is for high income people in particular, and extremely wealthy people, the rates on individual income taxes have gone down at the top end, and the estate tax has been weakened. Now, both of those things previously meant a larger tax break for charitable donations from very high income and wealth people, and that has also been lessened by the bill.
We're talking to Chai Ching Huang of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, with Tax Day right around the corner tomorrow. She's with us to talk about the changes Americans are seeing just 4 months into the Republican tax cut plan. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing more money in your paycheck? Are you a business owner hiring more people because of the law, or have you not noticed a big change yet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about the Republican tax cut law passed back in December, looking at the impact on Americans 4 months after they were signed into law. Chai Ching Huang is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with your questions. Do you work for a company that raised your pay or gave you a bonus after this law was signed? Do you think these tax cuts are good for the economy or bad? Are you worried about deficits? Call in with your questions and what you're seeing on your paycheck at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. Mark is with us in Sauk City. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for having this important conversation. I happen to work for AT&T, and in December they announced $1,000 bonuses for their workers, and our CEO did kind of a big push with employees, asking them to support this bill. And while they were, they did keep their promise of that $1,000 bonus, they also handed out a lot of pink slips. So to see coworkers being laid off, you know, while others maybe got a bonus, is kind of a chilling effect for, you know, a workplace. And I just want to share, too, that I think the tax plan seems to favor the super rich and wealthy corporations over working people. You know, in addition to giving corporations pretty sizable tax breaks, the bill greatly incentivizes, or, you know, it's an incentive for companies to outsource jobs, to conduct more and more business offshore, and to invest in offshore earnings in the financial markets rather than back into the domestic workforce. So that's one thing I'm kind of concerned about, and the stock buyback.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling in. A lot there to tackle. Chai Ching, let's start with that point he brought up first. Some companies giving bonuses. He says layoffs came along with that. Did we see that at other companies too?
Unfortunately, yes, that's actually been the story at a number of the companies that have made big announcements about bonuses or buybacks or asking for the tax cut, which is, again, one of the reasons why it's really important to sort of watch this as it plays out. Unfortunately, the last time that there was a large tax cut for foreign profits, we saw a similar thing with companies bringing back a lot of the money, paying it out to shareholders, and cutting jobs at the same time. That was in 2004. So we'll see over time whether or not these promised investment effects really kick in. But at the moment, from the initial data, we're not seeing an overwhelming response in one way or the other.
Mark, also saying that the tax cuts benefit people at the higher end. You were talking about that a little. We've seen concerns over rising income and wealth inequality over the last, 20, 30 years or so. Chai-Ching, how do you see that the new tax cuts fitting into that?
Right. It pushes exactly in the wrong direction if you were concerned with reducing that inequality and making up for some of the stagnant wage and salary growth that people in the bottom and in the middle have faced over the last 30 or 40 years. So immediately it does push in the wrong direction. I gave you the numbers before in terms of the raw dollar amounts, but even as a share of income, high income people in this bill, the top 1%, is getting about three times more than moderate income people. So, and the very, very top 0.1% is getting the biggest tax cuts as a share of their income still. So the main theory of the bill, I'm glad we're talking about the corporate tax cuts, was not about how it would directly impact paychecks, even though we are seeing some direct impact on paychecks. The main theory of the bill that proponents put forward was that the really large tax cuts for corporations and high-income people would stimulate growth that would help lower and moderate income people, which is why it's really important to sort of put a critical lens on that and ask whether or not that's likely. Unfortunately, research from previous tax cuts that were designed similarly suggests that that's not likely to be the case, that over time even, the tax cuts are likely to flow to shareholders, wealthy individuals, and high-paid CEOs rather than typical workers.
Thanks for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Julie with us in Ripon. Julie, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Julie?
Well, I receive about $80 extra a month in my paycheck from the tax cuts. However, I help support a disabled son who, if they use these tax cuts, it increases the debt, and that's used as a reason to cut Medicaid and food share. I will be paying out much more money to help him than I will be getting in my $80 a month tax cut.
Julie, thanks for the call. Julie, concerned about the long-term impact if the tax cuts and the deficit estimates result in cuts in spending. Chai-Ching.
I think that's a really important concern, especially given what lawmakers who supported the tax package have said. They have said, hot on the heels of the tax cut package, that yes, they are concerned about deficits, but their preferred way of addressing those deficits is to address so-called entitlements, what they call entitlements. Now, that's code language for provisions of the budget that include things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, support for housing assistance, and other critical programs. So if that's where the focus turns when it comes to addressing deficits and debt, including the $1.5 trillion that this bill added to those deficits, that's a really valid concern.
Thanks for that call, Julie, at 800-642-1234. Chai-Ching Wong is with us from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, looking at the impact of the tax cuts passed back in December. Back to your calls now. Terry is with us in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I recently got a pay raise at my employer, and it was merit-based on what I did there at the company and my efforts. But it definitely wasn't between $4,000 and $9,000 increase that was promised for average wage earners in this country for this tax bill if it passed. And I don't think that that is ever, ever going to happen, ever.
Terry, thanks for the call. Terry saying the wage increases that the White House has suggested will come with the tax cut plan probably aren't going to happen, Chai-Ching.
So what Terry is seeing on the ground and his perspective there is very much in alignment with what mainstream economists concluded. No mainstream economists have suggested that the wage gains, even if there was a big increase in investment from the corporate tax cuts, would get anywhere close to those levels that have been promised by the White House. Those are just far outside of what most economists have predicted based on prior tax cuts and international experience. So that's a really valid concern. And again, the question becomes that even if there is an increase in investment from the corporate tax cuts, if there is also an increase in deficits and debt at the same time that eventually have to be paid off, how are those going to be addressed? And how will that affect typical workers as opposed to the CEOs and the shareholders who are reaping the bulk of the benefits of the direct tax cuts?
Terry, thanks for the call. Good luck digging out up there in Green Bay. Chai-Ching, I should bring up the thought that, okay, yes, on paper, these tax cuts will raise the deficit. But if they give enough of a boost to economic activity, and you've already questioned that, but if they work in the way they're supposed to, that generates more tax revenue, it's going to at least diminish the deficit increasing effect of the tax cuts themselves.
That's right. So I think one important thing to know is the Congressional Budget Office just took another look at the cost of this bill. Because the economy is slightly bigger for tax, for reasons totally separate from the tax bill, they just revised their estimates. Their estimate of the cost before taking into account any growth that the bill would cause is about $1.9 trillion now. If you take into account the fact that the bill might lead to slightly higher growth, and you take into account the fact that it adds to deficits and debt, and that causes interest payments to go up, those two things virtually cancel out. So you end up with a cost of about $1.9 trillion after those factors as well. So when you take into account both any potential positive growth impact and also the negative impact that you're now paying interest on added debt that you wouldn't have previously, those two things are about the same magnitude, and you're still left with increases in the deficit that are, you know, $1.5 trillion or above that.
Chai-Ching, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Chai-Ching Wong is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She joined us to talk about the effects of the Republican tax cuts, which went into effect 4 months ago.